Welcome to the Gold Digger podcast series, a series that investigates the mysterious decline of Australian rugby union. It's a fan's journey into the void to pick up the pieces of Australian rugby union and find a path forward to fortune and glory. I'm your host and humble rugby servant, Matt Durrant. And welcome to episode 9 of this growing podcast series. I apologise for the delay in getting this episode out. When I first started this process of making a documentary about Australian rugby, one of the first people I spoke to was my father, chiefly because he's the main person who I talk to about rugby, but also because he was my coach once upon a time. And I wanted to pick his brain as to what he thought would be a good starting point for this quest on learning more about what's happened to our game. This is an excerpt of our conversation with my father, Chris Durrant, back in January of 2020.
Whenever you want to do something really well, what you do is look at the people who are already doing it really well and say, what are they doing? How are they doing it? So I would be looking very hard at New Zealand and saying, what is the secret of New Zealand's success? Because, okay, they didn't win the last World Cup, but they were probably the best side in it. And they have been the best side for years and years. So what is it that they're doing that we're not doing? So that's one thing I'd do as a sort of starting point. And I think we've also got to look perhaps a little bit more closely at what are the fundamental things that make a rugby team successful. As you know, when I was a coach, I was very much addicted to the Honan drills, which concentrated on skills, basic skills. Now that may not necessarily be the answer, but I suspect it might be. Because if you've got players at any level performing the simple things that you've got to do, you pass, kick, tackle, all those things, doing them really, really well without even having to think about them, then that gives you a huge amount of scope for building a really good rugby team.
The Honan drills were a set of training modules that I used as a junior through both club and school, and in fact, many people still use them today. You can jump on YouTube and find teams all around the world practicing the basic pass and tackle drills. The creator, of course, was Barry Honan, a former Wallaby, and a man who has devoted pretty much his entire life to rugby, not just as a player, but also as a coach, specifically a skills coach. Due to coronavirus, we couldn't get up to Queensland to film an interview with Barry, so I thought I'd get him on the pod. This is our conversation just last week. I'm in London, he's in Queensland, and we had a chat about a number of things. This is Barry Honan, Wallaby number 518.
Probably more so at high school, every pre-season, every training camp, we were all assembled around a TV and a VHS tape would go in. And it was your drills involving, you know, four players working through three or four zones, just doing simple passing and tackling drills. And I still remember most of them. And it was one of those things that was just hammered into us as players. Yeah. So that's certainly one thing I wanted to talk to you about, was how that came about.
Yeah, well, I as you know, most of my coaching over the last 50 years has been at school level. I make no excuses for that either, because the thing is, if you're coaching in one of these large rugby schools where you have, you know, up to 30, in the case of Marist Ashgrove, we used to have 32 teams. I was the rugby director of Ashgrove, then the Southport School on the Gold Coast, and for 3 years at Nudgee College. And like we had, the average number of teams we had at those schools would have been about 28 to 30. So when you've got teams, you have to have coaches. And to try to find coaches who'll put up their hand to take on such a responsibility was never easy. So right from the word go, I was concerned with of developing coaches and providing them with enough information, not just about sort of game tactics, but just providing them with the skills they needed and the techniques they needed to keep kids interested at training, so they don't drop out of the game as soon as they become bored, and also to improve, obviously, the quality of their rugby. And the measure of success was always, to me, and I used to hammer all the time to all the teachers, or sometimes the old boys who put up their hand to also coach. But the level of success to me was always at the end of the season, if the kids were playing better rugby and they wanted to turn up again the following year to play, then they've had a successful year. You know, whether they won a premiership or came second or third was quite irrelevant, really. I made the decision back in those days also not to put up my hand to try to coach at any great level, because as you, I think I've told you before, I've now got 5 children, 18 grandchildren, and the number one priority in my life has always been the family. Mm. And I've seen, unfortunately, what's happened to a lot of families where coaches have just become obsessed with rugby coaching and devoted so much time to that that their families had suffered. And I was never going to do that. So I became a sort of an expert, if you like. Oh, I shouldn't use that term. But I became known as a skills coach, a rugby skills coach. And that was fantastic because it enabled me to the hone and drills was the first thing that you mentioned before that I developed. And I still believe to this day there's few better ways of developing skills in young players than the skills involved with the hone and drills. Mm. Over a period of time after that, I don't know whether you're familiar with the Digi Rugby series that we put out also. I had a company called DigiSport, and we produced back in about 1994, we produced a product called Digi Rugby. Now, that was a multimedia-based, computer-based a coaching program aimed at coaches, but it had 365 drills and exercises in it with over, you know, nearly 300 separate videos and close to 1 million words of explanation. Now, that was developed, and I was hoping that multimedia program or software would have been distributed by Australian Rugby Union and literally sent out to all the coaches in our country to further the sort of thing that Dickie Marks was doing with his manuals that he put out prior to that. But it never happened. I remember sitting on the office with Matt Carroll and a couple of others at ARU headquarters in Sydney, but going back in mid-1990s. And unfortunately, it was... The response was, well, if they didn't develop it, they weren't interested. Even though there was a resource there that would have been fantastic for the development of coaches throughout the country. I went ahead and did it anyway. And then a couple of years later, when that program was finished, and of course, it was such a substantial program, it took 2 years actually to develop. But people overseas who had been using the Honan drills learned of somewhere, found out about the Digi Rugby too. And I was invited to go to the UK, I think it was about 1998, by the English Rugby Union. And I conducted, I think it was something like 40 coaching sessions through England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, a whole lot. It was attended by nearly 1,000 coaches. So the unfortunate thing was, as far as, you know, rugby coaching in Australia was concerned, there was a great opportunity missed by Australian coaches to make maximum benefit of the material that was contained in that program. Whereas, we saw more of that program in the UK. In fact, when I say more of, something like 10 times more of than we did in Australia, which was a great shame.
It's interesting as well that we obviously were one of the leaders or the first movers in putting all that material in an electronic format that would be far more available around the world. I mean, we're talking, the rise of the internet in sort of homes and businesses at that point in time. Was there anyone else doing that sort of work?
No. Well, a couple of years later, there was a Canadian company that produced a program quite similar to Digi Rugby, but it wasn't as comprehensive, and it didn't allow you to do all the things Digi Rugby could. For example, you know, you could select drills and exercises, save them, print them out. And the ease of use of Digi Rugby wasn't matched by that Canadian company. And in fact, I think after about within a decade, I think that company folded. But over the years, I mean, this is the sad thing as far as I'm concerned about Australian rugby. The Rugby League Foundation in Australia found out about Digi Rugby, and they got onto my company, DigiSport, at the time and asked us to produce a coaching program for rugby league called Pass, Catch, Kick. And the idea was they wanted this as an introductory program for that introduced rugby league into schools in all states of Australia. We produced it in about, it took us about 12 months to do that. And there was to be no body contact or tackling, because it was mainly for primary school teachers who could go out with a 40 minute or half an hour period and do some drills and exercises, throw some rugby league balls around and introduce them to the game. And 7,000 copies of that went out to primary schools all over Australia. And about 18 months after that, would you believe, they came back again and said, look, the schools are happy as anything, but the club coaches now, they'd like to be in on it as well. But, of course, they want to now see more body contact stuff and it's obviously, you know, tackling and defence introduced. So we expanded that and then produced a program called Pass, Catch, Kick, Tackle. Another 4,000 copies of that went out to junior rugby league coaches all over Australia. And, I mean, the sad thing is I'm a rugby man. I mean, I'm only doing this because I was asked to do it. But we lost a golden opportunity to have coaches throughout the country so far more skilled in what they could do at training. And the bottom line was what I learned with all the coaches that, you know, because I was the rugby master at three schools, Marist Ashgrove, then the Southport School, and then Nudgee College in Brisbane. And the main thing coaches want, they have to occupy kids at training. The first thing you've got to do is provide them with exercises and drills to do to fill up that training time. And as they do it and get interested and the kids sort of get interested, then they can look at tactics to play on the field. I mean, basically keep the game simple, but skill them up so that then you can introduce all sorts of tactics when you want to throughout the season. So, it was an opportunity lost anyway here in Australia.
I want to take you back. You've mentioned Marist a couple of times. Now, that was your you're an alumni of Marist Brothers, is that right?
Yes.
And the other thing that struck me when I was looking at your bio was that you also played at Brothers. So both of those, that school and that club, that's where there's a lot of talent. A lot of Wallabies have come through those ranks, haven't they?
Yes, very much so. In fact, there was an article in The Australian just recently that it was all about schools throughout Queensland that had produced the most, not just rugby players, basically sporting families. Mm. And it actually mentioned at the end that Marist College, in fact, probably was the top of the tree in providing. I'm talking about Michael Bowl at swimming Matthew Haddon at cricket. It went through the whole lot. But according to their research anyway, Marist Ashgrove, was the head of the list.
You played for Queensland when you were 18, which is incredibly young, even at any stage. How was that when you sort of moved up into senior ranks and straight away, playing rep footy?
Well, I was very nervous, of course, as you would be at 18, but I was actually picked my first year, that was 1967. I was picked to go to New Zealand also with the Wallabies. There was a one-off test match to be played in Wellington to celebrate New Zealand's 75th anniversary. And this is coming back to laws again, which we're going to talk about also. But it just reminds me of the law changes that have occurred over this period of time. Because in 1967, there were no reserves. The squad was 20. It was a one-off test match, so there were 20 guys picked. And when I say there were no reserves, once the team of 15 had been picked, the reserves, and I was one. I was 18 years old then. And Johnny Hipwell was the other. But it was only two backs, one the halfback, of course, and one utility back, and three forwards. But once the team was picked, the reserves sat in the grandstand in their blazers. And in that game, 10 minutes into the game, Phil Smith, one of the centres, who you may remember, broke his collarbone. And they took him off the field into the dressing room. It was his left arm. They strapped his left arm to his body. Then they put him back on the wing so he could catch with his right hand. And he played three quarters of the game with a broken collarbone, his left arm strapped to his body. It was that particular injury and incident that introduced the law change the following year about reserves. I mean, that was just ridiculous, you know. And I remember 64, my last 64 and five, my last couple of years at school, I remember watching a test match at the old Lang Park in Brisbane. In those days, the only besides the exhibition ground, we had the Normandy, which was the ground where a lot of interstate matches were played, but it had a capacity of about 8,000-9,000. So this match was played at Lang Park. But even then, back in 64, you could kick out on a full from anywhere in the field. And I remember the Wallabies played the Springboks, and the whole game was just kicking the ball out from one end of the field to the other to gain ground and having lineouts. I mean, so rugby in lots of ways has come a long way, but in recent years, unfortunately, I believe it's gone backwards again.
Your Wallaby career, or your rugby career, was ended through an injury to your cruciate ligament.
Yeah, no, in fact, my first year out of school playing Colts, I snapped a cruciate ligament, and it was back in the days where they didn't do the operation they have now. Like Timmy Horan, for example, had a similar snapped cruciate and did the similar damage to his knee than I did. But he had a year off, but the following year he was back and his knee was as good as anything. Whereas back in those days, that operation didn't exist. So I missed the rest of that season, and it was the next season I came back, but not after having an operation. I got onto a very good physiotherapist who showed me a way of strapping my knee up in such a way that the strapping would compensate with a snapped anterior cruciate ligament. And in fact, I played my entire rugby career with my knee strapped and a snapped cruciate ligament. And it was only after I came back from South Africa in 1969, after, you know, I'd played something like 15 games. I think I mentioned it to you in an earlier conversation, but my knee was no good when I went over there. I probably shouldn't have even been picked because I didn't even play for 3 weeks before the tour went away. But anyway, so I missed the first five games over there on tour. It was a 26-match tour. And of the 21 remaining games, I played 15. So you're playing Wednesday, Saturday, and in between I was just visiting a physio. I hardly ever trained. But at the end of it, my knee was so bad. The looseness in my knee became so bad. The cartilages were going. I was stretching other ligaments. So I had to have an operation. So I had one as soon as I got back, basically, which kept me out of all night. 1970, I didn't play a game. So I had a whole year off. So I came back in early 71 then and tried to continue my rugby career, but my knee was never any good. That was nearly the end of it, except, interestingly, I did come back and have a few games for Brothers, and I was lucky enough to make the Queensland team, and I probably shouldn't have. I mean, I don't know, I even made the team, because at that stage, seriously, I thought I'd slowed down a hell of a lot, and why they picked me, I still really don't know. But they not only picked me, this is how lucky I was. Jules Gerasimov was our captain, and Jules got injured because we played the British Lions. The British Lions toured Australia and New Zealand in 1971, and their first game on that tour was in Queensland, and we played them there at Ballymore. And of course, Queensland won that game. It was the only provincial game the Lions ever been beaten in. So Johnny Dawes was their captain. And on the way through, you might have seen in sort of more recent tours, they have a mascot. They have this Lions mascot with, you know, the flags of the different countries sticking out there to the mascot. Well, they didn't really have one in 71, but on their way through, they came through Singapore. And I think somewhere along the line, so the story goes that Johnny Dawes told me, that they decided to get this mascot. So they picked up this really cheap little lion, stuck some flags in the top. And it was a mascot in a certain way, I suppose. But the deal was that they were going to present it to the captain of the first team if there was any team that beat them on that tour, because the 71 Lions was, that was probably one of the best Lions teams of all time, you see. So it didn't last one game. So at the after dinner function, Johnny Dawes has presented me with this Lions. So look, it's a great memory and probably one of my greatest memories of my rugby career, to be honest with you.
Well, I mean, what a way to go out after your Wallaby career is over. You still
well, it was the last game I played. That was it.
You would 100% leave after that game. That is the best one to leave on, I think. It's interesting. I was just sort of again looking at some of your the games with the Wallabies, and it maybe, you know, both your versatility, but also what you were talking about before with having lack of. A big squads. You moved around in a lot of different positions: centre, wing, fullback, or both centres. Was that just something out of necessity to cover positions that needed to happen?
Yes, it really was. Yeah, I played in every position in the back line for the Wallabies except scrum half. I never got a chance to play scrum half. Mm. I'd probably my size, I never made 12 stone. So back in those days, probably scrum half would have been my best position. But luckily, anyway, in those, we had Johnny Hipwell was our scrum half in all my rugby career. Well, actually, not quite, because my first game for the Wallabies was in 1968, and it was a test match in Sydney against the All Blacks, and that was the game where Colin Meads ripped the hamstring off the bone of Kenny Catchpole, remember? Yeah. And Johnny Hipwell came on as a replacement for that. And in fact, I came on as a replacement from Johnny Brass. He was also injured. So that's where both my rugby career started and also Johnny Hipwell. And Hippy was, I mean, he was a sensational player. I mean, you know, they talk about Johnny Hipwell and Des Connor and, you know, all the greats of the game, Kenny Catchpole. But I tell you what, if any of them were any better than Johnny Hipwell, I'd be very surprised. He was magnificent.
I've heard a few times about and read about that infamous controversy with Meads. What was the players' reaction, the other sort of players that were still on the field reaction to that?
They weren't very happy, obviously, but back in those days, 67, like rugby was a bit of a free-for-all. I mean, it was in the same game where Peter Riley, who was also a fellow Brothers player, who played for Queensland, and Pete was never any – like he wasn't a great player, but he was a courageous player, and he'd stand up to anybody. But he was a pretty good line-out jumper, and he was marking Colin Meads. This is early in this game now. That incident happened, I think, just 10 minutes into the second half. But in about 10 minutes into this game, Peter Riley had won a couple of line-outs off Colin Meads, and he wasn't terribly happy about it. And he basically looked across and said to Riley, you know, he said, you jump for this next one. He said, it'll be the last thing you do on the field. So, Pete, you know, I mean, here's Colin Meads, the guy with, you know, one of the most well-known and famous bloody players in the world. Mm. And Pete, this was his first test. So, Pete, of course, I mean, he's not going to take that. So, of course, he went up for it, came down with the ball, and Meads has got him with his elbow and just flattened him and laid him out, you know?
Yeah.
But he got up and he played the rest of the game. And I think Meads must have been taken by the fact that he had the guts to keep jumping, because he didn't touch him after that. But that's what rugby was like those in those. You know, okay, Hippy's come. We didn't know how serious Hippy's injury was during the game neither, you know. He's gone off. It was only till after the game we realised that injury ended his rugby career. Yeah. But incidents like that were happening back in those days all the time. God.
So you move into, I guess, coaching. Was it a quick progression from your playing career ending and then I guess coaching and you were a development officer with Queensland as well, is that right?
Yes, but that was only when I left teaching. I chose to spend a year at the Queensland Rugby Union as a development officer. What was that? That was 1987, the year of the first Rugby World Cup.
Right.
So I picked a good year because the Rugby World Cup was played in Australia and New Zealand. I was never going to stay in that position. I mean, I had five kids at that stage and I was on something like $21,000 a year with a broken down Holden car trying to feed five kids. So it was only ever going to be a year long stint for me, but I loved it because number one, I enjoyed doing what I was doing, but also being there for Rugby World Cup was just a big bonus, you know?
Yeah. the last couple of episodes, I've talked with a couple of people, well, talked with one person, and we looked at a little bit of history of Australian rugby. And one of the things that came out that seemed to be very significant is the rise of Queensland in the 70s and how that really, you know, there was this sort of groundswell of talent and interest from Queensland that then sort of flooded up to the Wallabies. Yes. Were you sort of, I mean, you know, were you ever involved or in the development or, you know, working with any of the coaches around that time?
Not on a permanent basis, no. I was invited on a number of occasions, with whether it was from Bob Temple or later on with John Connolly. You know, I was once again a guest with doing some skills stuff and working, doing some specialised stuff with backs again. But no, not really, because I was actually totally involved at school level at that stage. I became president of the Queensland Schools Rugby Union, and I was coach of the Queensland Schools team also for 8 years. So, I mean, I was, over that period of time, I was very much involved at that level. It was only sort of after I'd left teaching that I got these invitations to go over. Like, I was lucky enough over the years to coach in Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, South Africa, England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, New Zealand, Argentina, America, you know, so I was having a ball. I mean, I didn't have the responsibility of having to look after a team, but I was being asked to come along and contribute as a specialist skills coach and a specialist backline coach. And I loved every minute of it. And I thought to myself, why would I do anything else?
When did international or rep teams start bringing in more specialised coaches? You know, you had your head coach for many years or... And I don't know if that was a, you know, but when did they really start getting into to the point where, you know, now we have almost, it feels like a coach for every single discipline and facet of a team.
Matt, I couldn't put an exact year on that, to be honest with you, but you know, we won the World Cup in 91. Probably I'd say the early 90s in Australia anyway, because like Alan Jones was a successful coach at Wallaby level, as you know, but he's a very smart guy, Alan Jones, and he's never coached me, so I can't rate him as a coach, but he was a motivator, and he's being as smart and as intelligent as he is, he was smart enough to know that you needed specialised coaches to help out various positions. So, you know, Alec Evans, you know, Dick Marks, like he'd get anybody that he thought could add value to the team to come in and assist. Mm. So I wouldn't be surprised if that early 90s was the time where that happened. But nowadays, I mean, God, I looked at the Queensland squad. I mean, there were 24 forwards in the squad, 14 backs and 14 assistants, you know, like there's a coach for everything nowadays. And I think personally that's gone too far anyway, you know.
So I guess that's the thing. Let's talk a bit about Australian rugby as it is, but even we can go back as far as we want, because I think obviously your contention and others is that there are things that have happened probably almost 2 to 3 decades ago that are now having impacts and consequences on the way the game is now. So what's sort of some of the, what are some of the main sort of areas you think have impacted Australia?
The biggest change that's happened to rugby, I believe, was in 1996. The use it or lose it law was brought into rugby. Now, it was brought in for very good reasons, but it's the same old story, you know, like you change anything and there can be unintended consequences. But it was brought in because back in those days, the maul was as common as the ruck. In fact, it was probably more common. So teams prior to 1996 would be forming mauls all over the field and driving mauls down the field and gaining 10, 15 metres. They weren't doing this passing the ball back to the last man which is basically legitimate obstruction nowadays, you know. They weren't doing that, and players weren't working their way through from the front of the maul to the back with the ball, which now is become, well, according to the laws of the game now, they're saying is illegal despite the fact they do it all the time. So the maul was sort of dominating the game to the point where it was too easy to gain ground and, in fact, score tries. And it's where the rolling maul first started. So the use it or lose it law was introduced then, And then for 4 or 5 years, probably till after 2000, things were working okay. But it's got to the stage now, the only malls you ever see are rolling malls near the try line, and the malls you see from lineouts, like they form mall from lineouts. I'll get back to that in a moment, where I'm opposed to that anyway. But what you do see all of is this, and I'm not even sure what you call it, where players go up and they just go to ground. And you see, I've got millions of little photographs of five players from an attacking team, you know, over the ball, standing over the ball, not one defender there at all. So effectively, they've got 15 players in the defence line, all at 0 meters, and the opposition, they're outnumbered by 3 or 4 players, and there's nowhere to go. So the 1996 use it or lose it law was the biggest thing that changed rugby. And from about 2000 onwards, it's been a blight on the game, but people don't seem to see that and don't realize that unless they do something about it, it's really crucifying the game, I believe, you know. Like you can have 23 phases of that sort of thing going on with the team going nowhere. A lot of my friends are commenting on the way rugby's played, and they're saying, "Oh, they hate the up and under, you know, they hate the box kick." And I keep saying, "Well, I don't particularly like it either." But if you've had 12, 13 phases that have been going backwards, you're going to have more success from a decent box kick. Give it to them, and let's put them under pressure and let them see how they can go. I don't like box kicking either, but you just basically have to do it nowadays.
I'm going to include this link on a Facebook page so people who are listening to this can actually watch it. But you, just last year, in fact, during, it was probably lockdown material, but you did a Rugby Must Change 5-part series on YouTube, and you've gone back and you've broken down all of these things about, you know, the game in terms of what is changing and the impacts with evidence, with video evidence of, you know, games from the sort of the 90s, but also 80s and 90s, in fact, but also through to last year's Super Rugby AU season. Was that something that had been, you'd been working on for a number of years, or did you sort of put that together last year?
Yeah, no, not really. What happened with that, beginning of the year, I was supposed to do a workshop for the QRU with QRU staff and also a number of selected coaches and referees. Now, the week I was supposed to do it, COVID hit, basically, so that it didn't happen. So I thought to myself, well, look, you know, it wasn't just a meeting. It was a morning workshop it was supposed to be. So I thought, well, look, I'll try to organize and do this by Zoom. But as you know, you've seen the videos. Because it's so video intensive, that presentation of the workshop I was going to do, it didn't work very well on Zoom. You know, I experimented with it for a few weeks. Then I thought, no, well, what can I do now? Because we weren't going to be having meetings. And I thought, well, look, I'll try putting a couple of videos together. I didn't intend it to be 5 30-minute videos, to be honest with you, but a bit like the documents you do. Once you start, you know, there was so much to cover that it ended up being 4 videos on Rugby Must Change, basically outlining the problems I see with the current game at elite level. And I stress that. And then video number 5 was basically some suggestions as to how we can go to improve the watchability of the game. But you're right. But, you know, like it took 4 videos to cover things like, I mean, we talk about the time wastage in the game now is just ridiculous. I mean, when you have the last 2 test matches played in Australia this year, the last match when the Pumas played the All Blacks, there was 32 minutes of play in the game. In the one before it, when the Wallabies played the Puma, there was 28 minutes 30 seconds in the game.
Which is just, well, it's astounding to me. And I think that was probably my biggest takeaway when I watched those videos, because I've always thought that, you know, we are seeing less rugby. I think we all know that. There's scrums that go for 2 minutes and, you know, all sorts of time delays and things. But that for me was just, there it was, you know, you're effectively saying not far off a quarter of a game is actual action. And, you know, if you're in Australia, and anyone who's sort of listening from overseas has to appreciate that the alternative to 20, 30 minutes of rugby action, you can go and watch rugby league and probably AFL, and you get, you know, a full hour minimum of constant action, ball in motion, movement, points, things happening. And that's, and I know that's had an effect on people I've talked to, because I've got a few mates who I've spoke to the documentary, and even sort of off camera, who are rugby union, you know, fans, and they are starting to lose interest with, you know, the rucks, the gate, what is the gate, you know, the scrum, what is even happening in the front row. And very few people could pinpoint it. And it is turning people away.
Well, as you said before, the average rugby league game, it is 60. You're spot on. It's about an hour. It's around 60 minutes every time. Right. And Aussie rules is, you know, it's played in four quarters of 20 minutes. But there's a time clock. Every time play stops for anything, so does the clock. So they get a full 80 minutes every time they play. Mm. So that's something about that has to be done. And the scrums, yes, the most time is wasted at scrums, but it's not just time wasting at scrums is the problem. The scrums itself are a problem. I mean, it's crazy that you know, you can get 40 to 50% of all scrums collapsing, and 30 to 40% of all scrums are resulting in penalties, not possession. I mean, that's not what people want, you know. Now, half the penalties that come from a scrum is followed by a kick to the corner where they have a line out and a driving maul.
Yeah.
You know, the backs half the time don't even work up a sweat.
And I think that it was a very interesting statistic that you also produced, which was looking at the number of breakdowns, or average breakdowns in a game, looking at, you know, the 90s and even up until 95, but 1999, when the Wallabies won, in fact, seems to be when there was a massive increase in the number of breakdowns per game.
That's the other huge change in the game, I think, to its detriment. If you look at the, you know, American football, a lot of people will rubbish American football, saying, oh, it's too stop and start. But, you know, it has more followers and viewers than any other code of football in the world, you know, probably except for soccer, I'd say. But why do they put up with it? I mean, the fact is, every time they have a down, you know, what happens after the down is really interesting. You know what I mean? Mm. And the ploys and the tactics for every time at one of those American football downs, the people find extremely interesting. And they'll put up with a 20-second wait for a down if then they're going to see something that's interesting. But, you know, scrums aren't particularly interesting to start off with. When they're taking 94 seconds, sometimes a minute and a half to get a result, and then you get a penalty, or then you get a number eight running off, or a 5-8 kicking the ball. I mean, you know, waiting for a set play is one thing, but it's what follows that's going to interest the average viewer. And right now, not much is being done from scrums that's entertaining anybody. If you went back to 1997, the average number of scrum possessions in a game was 28, and lineouts were 34. So, you know, you've got 62 possessions from set play. And back in those days, nearly every one of those scrums resulted in – there were hardly any scrum penalties. There were hardly any scrum collapses. So nearly every one of those set plays resulted in something, and particularly some back play. And those were the days when backs used to go and train. They'd go on the field with as many as 20 moves up their sleeve and get the opportunity to have at least five or six of them in any one game. But it went from that to – you jump ahead to 2019 Rugby World Cup. On average, there were 10 scrums that resulted in possession and 21 lineouts. So, you know, it went from 52 to 31 set plays. But the big thing was the rucks and mauls, the breakdowns. Back in the World Cup 1997, there were 38. because that was the days when if there was a breakdown, remember all the forwards used to, if it was a maul, you had to get in there because you got possession, the team that drove forward. Mm. And rucking, of course, was in back in those days. So forwards were involved in every one of those breakdowns. But there was only, on average, 38 of them in the game because a lot of the time was taken up with the set plays and what was happening from set plays. But now in 2019, I mentioned before there were 31 total scrums and lineouts, but there were 169 on average breakdowns. And that's that phase where there's 0 meter defense line, they're outnumbered, and most of the teams now can see the advantage of a form of rush up defense. So they always have one or two players out wide, basically almost making it impossible to get the ball wide without taking an enormous risk.
I guess one of the things that occurred to me around the scrums, at least, is that at some point in the last 30 odd years, there have been changes around making the scrum safer. And that's obviously, you know, I remember it used to go from just, you know, engage to sort of crouch, touch, and then engage, then crouch, touch, pause, and engage. I don't even know what it is now, but that certainly has to have impacted at all levels and even the top levels, the delay in the scrums.
Yeah, it has. Look, I have no doubt the scrums, well, I'll rephrase that. I think there's evidence that scrums have become safer because of the new protocol that's been introduced. But it's the protocol that's half the reason why scrums are taking so long. And look, I'm no expert on scrums. I've never professed to be. So I'll leave it to those that know a hell of a lot more about scrummaging than I do, but something has to be done to improve the speed of the scrums and to stop the number of collapses that's occurring. I mean, it's basically killing our game. Mm. So something has to be done. And, look, I've got some ideas, but as I said, I'll leave it to those, the expert scrummagers, to come up with a solution.
And I suppose that's the rub, because if we... You know, we mentioned rugby league and AFL. If they want to change their laws, they can basically wave a magic wand and do it, because they effectively run their own games. But with Australia, something that might be affecting us in Australia has to obviously go through world rugby. And you know, whether Rugby Australia has that leverage or other countries see it as a problem is another thing. So, you know, what realistically can Rugby Australia do to try and impact or to try and sort of change the game so that we can be addressing these problems?
Oh, yeah, look, at world rugby level, I think we're quite limited. World rugby introduced a number of law amendments to be trialled in various countries. The various unions were asked to use as many of those suggestions as possible and report back to them before the World Cup and then after the World Cup to seriously consider them for implementation. Mm. Now, the amendments that they suggested, that, you know, the possible changes really didn't have much impact on the game whatsoever. You know, there was one where a 5 meter scrum became a five meter dropout. They introduced also the one where they said that in a maul situation, you couldn't work your way towards the back of the maul, you know, which players were doing, but they continue to do it anyway. So, I mean, there was three or four laws that they made a suggestion about changing the point system, where the try was worth six, and all other, you know, conversions, field goals, conversions, and penalties, they'll be worth 2 points. And that was trial, and that was quite positive. But it never went anywhere after the Rugby World Cup anyway. Mm. But here in Australia, like, we've tried our best. As you know, I was a member of an independent group of guys. There was Dick Marks, the Rod McQueen, Greg Cornelson, Andrew Slack, David Clark, and myself. As a result of putting those videos we mentioned before, I might have produced them, but I only produced them after many meetings and conversations with those guys as part of our independent group, at the end of which we actually put a submission through to Australian Rugby to actually trial some of our suggested amendments in Super Rugby in 1999. But it just didn't happen. We were told that it was too late, it was too difficult, There was all sorts of reasons they came up with, you know, but anyway, it didn't happen. So we then realised that if we're going to get anything done, we have to work from inside Rugby Australia, not from outside it. And thankfully now, as I think we've mentioned before, this National Technical Advisory Committee, which I've been asked to join, is a body of similar experienced rugby people. But now we're an advisory body to the Australian Rugby or Rugby Union, Rugby Australia. And submissions have already been put to them for consideration of law, what we're calling law dispensations. Mm. We're not trying to ask World Rugby to change laws. We're asking permission for here in Australia to get dispensations to try some of the suggested law variations that we'd like to try. Hopefully, we can get somewhere with that. It won't happen overnight. We have a meeting, in fact, next week where a lot of this is going to be discussed. And the idea would be in this year to introduce a number of these dispensation laws into different levels of the game. For there might be a regional competition like the Sunshine Coast where I live, or the Gold Coast, or somewhere in Sydney, North Sydney or somewhere, where they can be trialled. And we can come together at the end of that and discuss it, see how it's gone, and go from there. And there will be, as I mentioned before, no matter what you do, what changes you make, there'll always be unintended consequences which will have to be worked through. And hopefully by the end of the year, with some agreement, we can try to introduce them at a higher level, possibly even at Super Rugby level, if we get the okay from it with our New Zealand part. I know for a fact that even in New Zealand, as great as rugby is over there and has never died, they haven't got the same problems we have here in Australia, because it's really their national sport. It'll never die there. And rugby league it's got a bit of a foothold, but it will never take over from rugby union over there. But there's a lot of concern in New Zealand circles also that the game at the elite level is not what it should be. So I'm quite confident with the contacts I've got in New Zealand as well, that at the end of the season where these things are trialled, we may be able to do something across the Tasman as well and get something introduced at Super Rugby level. And after that, who knows? World Rugby, you never know. They might set up and listen.
So I wanted to just make it clear to anyone listening. So this is a National Technical Advisory Committee that was set up in just last year, 2020?
At the end, they've had one meeting already. I wasn't involved initially, but at that meeting, apparently, somebody suggested that because of my background and the analysis and stuff that I've been doing and submitting over the last couple of years, that I be invited to join that committee. So my first meeting with the committee will be another Zoom meeting, of course, because we can't get together at this stage.
Yeah.
But that'll be next week, yes.
Right. But it's an advisory committee that will be directly advising Rugby Australia on all these sorts of recommendations.
Well, yeah, and it's not just about laws. It's an advisory committee. From the meeting that they already had, they already put forward, there was advice on as many as 10 different areas, you know. We're talking about pathways for coaches and players and officials, you know, whether or not Wallabies playing overseas, selection criteria for them to play for the Wallabies back here. There was 10 things that they outlined. So the laws are my major concern, and it's going to be a focus on the next meeting that we have, because if something's going to happen in 2021, we have to get something done quickly. Otherwise, we'll be waiting another year to get things implemented. But no, it's advice on any area, basically, the game in Australia. And it's a great idea. And in fact, it was Dickie Marks, I think, with Jeff Stook from West Australia, who I think you know, who are instrumental in putting forward the 10 suggestions they've already made to us, to Rugby Australia.
So, I mean, look, yeah, man, Jeff Stook, obviously, he is very well known in Perth rugby. He's been involved many years, but he was a ARU or Rugby Australia board member. But then Dick, and I think we mentioned off before we started recording about Dick Marks and his work in the 70s from 1974 or 75, I think, when the National Coaching Clinic was set up.
Yeah, it was around about then. I know the exact date myself. Dick would know, but it was about 73, 74.
I mean, I've sort of touched upon this in the documentary, but I am curious to know whether, you know, the loss of our intellectual property or utilizing the intellectual property that we've had and the skills and the knowledge and people like yourself, 20, 25 years ago, whether that is, you know, directly impacting what we're seeing happening in the game today.
Yeah, well, one of Dick's, Dick was the national coaching director back in that era. And it's a position that once he left that position, it hasn't been filled since. So one of the recommendations, we're talking about suggestions and recommendations from NTAC, is to once again establish a national director of coaching. And I think that's got to be also one of the things we'll strongly push for. As I mentioned before, the golden era, if you like, of Australian rugby occurred once we had a national director of coaching who was responsible for coaching programs, pathways for, you know, players, coaches, all levels of the game. And that's been sorely missing now ever since then. So it's a good step in the right direction to go back and appoint somebody.
Yeah.
And it's not up to our particular committee to appoint anybody. It's only to recommend that such a person be appointed. But I think the recommendation will be such a strong one that will happen. And I just hope that they get somebody who's the right person for the job.
That golden era you just mentioned, I mean, I did a podcast looking at just that, the way we changed the tide in 97 to 99, yes, and then talked about the success that team had a couple of seasons later. But, you know, it seemed to be there was a factory of players coming through. If you go back and actually look at some of those guys, their careers started at the early 90s and really, you know, some of them were playing in the 80s and it took shape. Do you think there's a tendency in sport, but certainly in Australian rugby, for a team to have success and whoever happens to be either the coach or the director of the development or the CEO or on the board, they get the credit for something that actually is the result of work and plans that have been made and development almost a decade earlier?
Yeah, no, look, I'm sure about that. I mean, there was a case of people resting on their laurels, you know, after that golden sort of era. But you know, like you don't always have, like those teams we had back in those days, what stood out mainly was we had forward packs back in those days who could not only match it with any other rugby playing nation, but probably even dominate, basically, you know. But prior to that, our forwards, we never had the bulk, the strength, or even sometimes even the techniques involved in set plays to be able to give the backs. The Australians always had decent, good back lines, good back line players. But in that particular era we're talking about now, we had both. And after that era, you know, our forward packs have always struggled against powerful packs like the Box, or even Argentina would come over here and outscrum us, you know. And so just getting quality possession to play the sort of rugby that the players back in that, you know, that particular era played, they had to get good quality possession to start off with. And since then, it hasn't been that good, to be honest with you. We struggle against most nations now when it comes to set plays.
I've certainly think, and I've heard from a few people that there is an accepted notion that we were complacent at the turn of the century about what it was that was really the core of some of our success, and that there were just areas that weren't addressed. And, you know, high performance and these sorts of areas, I think everyone agrees that that was always going to be the something that we needed to do in the professional era. But the question is, did we do it in the right way? And I mean, you know, hearing from yourself that work that you were putting forward that had years of you know, data to back it up was then not sort of taken on, but then you went overseas and were able to sort of do clinics, you know, that just seems like a huge loss.
Well, I've done 10 times more coaching overseas than I've done in Australia, I'll be honest with you, and which, as I said, something I'm not terribly proud of and something that I regret. It's a great regret. But however, that's how it is, and you know, there's no going backwards now. But
do you think on a general level across Australia, techniques and basic skills still need to be addressed, and that we've gone backwards at all?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's like we always compare ourselves to the Kiwis, you know, because they're our neighbour. We play them all the time. Kiwis, who love their rugby, as we all know, they play the game, you know, since they're from 4 or 5 years old, and they get so much rugby. Like an average school team over in, say, Auckland would play 25 games a season. Like in Brisbane, whether you're playing in the, you know, the top line GPS competition in Brisbane, well, you're going to have, you'd have 7 games in competition and probably 4 or 5 trial games or something. Mm. You know, we talk about technique and skill, like skills are techniques, you know, under pressure. Well, you know, you can teach techniques all you like, but I mean, the way you become skillful is not only by the right sort of training exercises and so on, but also the pressure of matches. And there's no better way. I've always said the best training is always done on Saturday when you're out there under pressure. And the more games you play, the more skillful you're going to become, particularly if you've got a coach who can guide you.
Well, that's an interesting point, mate, because we touched back on the rise of Queensland and, you know, some of the research I was doing, it was interesting that in the 70s, Queensland started playing a lot more games as a province compared to New South Wales. And they would go on tours and play, and in fact, just play more games against visiting teams.
Yes.
You know, how critical do you think that has been and that could be for having, you know, more teams that are in development representative academies playing more games together so that, you know, you have a situation where, you know, if two players are playing for the Waratahs or the Reds or the Brumbies, whoever, that's not their first game together. They've actually got stuff in the bank.
Yeah, no, I think that's essential. In fact, one of the recommendations that the committee has already made is to establish an Australian A team.
Yeah.
And that Australian A team to play, you know, games in Southeast Asia, the islands, to play, literally to give them as many as 15 games a year as Australian A. And I can't think of any better way to develop their skills, you know, than that. And I'd love to see that happen. But at this stage, that also is only a recommendation. Mm. But we'll see what happens with that when it goes to Rugby Australia. But you're right. You, the more games you play, the better.
Do you think that there's a style of Australian rugby that we could, in this professional era, with all of these issues around limitations that the law has kind of created on teams to be inventive, original, do you still think there's a way in which we can create our own brand, our running rugby style, or if that still is possible, or maybe something else?
Well, Australia used to pride ourselves as a nation of, you know, running, of playing running rugby. I don't see rugby at elite level now as running rugby at all. I see it as collision rugby. And the current laws make running rugby quite difficult, to be honest with you, because of the amount of possession you get from that breakdown situation. It makes running rugby very, very hard. If you look at New Zealand and you see a lot of those wonderful games that you can see from Kiwiland, some of the best running rugby comes from broken play. You know, it comes from turnovers. It comes from, if you're silly enough to kick the ball to their outstanding back three, then, you know, you could suffer the consequences. So a lot of the best play you see in rugby is broken play as I said, from kick ball, a turnover position and that sort of thing. Look, I would love to think that down the track, Australia could once again be looked at as a nation typified by running rugby. But under the laws, I don't see how it's even possible.
So I was talking about, you mentioned the collision, the game of collisions, and so how that is going to be difficult for us to sort of change and adapt. Because Michael Checker was pillared at the last World Cup for sort of, you know, a number of things, but like one was sort of making the Wallabies run with the ball. But, you know, part of me, I was in two minds because I thought, yeah, you want to be sensible. Why are we running out of our 22? But there was this sort of hope that we could just try and do what Japan seemed to be doing, which was play expansive, play quick, open the game up and try and, you know, change the strategy on some of these other countries.
Well, you mentioned Japan, and I'm pleased you have. I mean, anybody wanting to play an expansive running rugby style of game, they've got Japan as the template. Basically, I mean, like the most interesting games and most entertaining games I saw at that last Rugby World Cup were the games involving Japan, whether it was Japan, Scotland, or, you know, Japan, South Africa. I mean, they were simply fabulous. I mean, they didn't dominate any pack, any forward pack, but they held their own with most. But they knew right from the word go that if they were going to have any level of success, they had to play with speed, they had to have the right tactics, and they did. But they also had to have a really highly advanced level of skill, which they exhibited every game they played. Their skill level, I thought, like you're talking about, you know, skills under pressure. Nobody was under more pressure than the Japanese in any game that they played. But their skill level was astonishing. And I started taking statistics on Japan as well. I haven't finished them yet, but I'm going to go back and finish it because I think their performances at that Rugby World Cup were quite quite outstanding.
Eddie Jones recently came out and stated quite publicly that he thought rugby needs less reserves to basically try and create more exhaustion of teams, but also try to open
absolutely
up the game.
Absolutely.
Is that a recommendation you think the NTAC will...
It's not one of the recommendations currently, but it will be. Well, at least I'll put it forward anyway, and I'm sure we'll get an agreement on that. I mean, yeah, I agree with you with that. It's crazy that in most of those games, those elite-level games now, depending on the state of the game, of course, but nearly always you'll get 22 or 23 of the players on the field at some stage. And sometimes I think one thing that's always annoyed me is that when you get somebody coming on with 5 minutes of the game to go, sometimes 2 minutes, and they get a cap for representing Australia or New Zealand or something. I mean, that's crazy stuff. And also the patrons, of course, have paid very good money to go and watch the best players play. And, you know, it's not fair that in the last 20 minutes of the game sometimes, like a team might be up, but they're still enjoying watching some of the best players in the world play.
Yeah.
And then they're taken off, and okay, you give the reserves a chance. I understand the reasons for it, but I don't think it that doesn't also help the game, I think, as a spectacle.
Yeah. So, look, we're probably rounding up to wrap this up. I don't know if you've got to go have dinner. I've got to, but mate, I guess sort of, you know, what I'm really interested in is the fact that you're someone who's been involved with the game for a very long time, and you're now working with other people on a committee, at least, who've had involvement for many years. Are you optimistic about the next phase of Australian rugby in that, you know, COVID brought about all these things that had been brimming under the surface, the finances of the game, you know, the board had sort of changed. Obviously, we had a new CEO. So there's been this sort of reset. There's now a new broadcaster in Stan and Channel 9. And obviously there's initiatives like your committee and maybe there's other things going on in the background that I'm not aware of. But are you optimistic that rugby's had a reset and that they're actually going to try and turn the tide from the last, you know, two decades?
Yes, I am optimistic, but not so much in the short term. Like, there's so much to be done. I'm not optimistic that there's going to be any great turnaround in 2021. You know, over a 3 or 4 year period, yes, I am optimistic. And I think there are enough highly intelligent, well-credentialed people now involved at administrative level and on the various committees that are being formed to actually see the changes that have to be made, you know, at administration level. We mentioned coaching before, at even the skill development level of our players, broadening the base. There's so much to be done, but I think there is a determination to get that done, and there's no shortcuts, Matt. You know, they have to come up, I think, with a 3 or 4 year plan. Yeah. And I am optimistic that in 3 or 4 years, you know, we can once again climb up that ladder of our position internationally. I think, where are we sitting now? We're about number 5 or 6 or something. Where are we now?
We're 6th or 7th.
Seven now, sorry. Well, I'm very optimistic.
We were 7th after the World Cup 2019. We went up to 6. Right. So I think the Welsh basically dropped back down after a pretty...
Right, big... okay.
But yeah, I mean, look, there certainly seems to be an acknowledgement amongst all sorts of circles that, you know, we can't let this continue and certain things have to change. Yeah. I guess my cynicism has always been, though, that rugby has always had a lot of different factions and battle lines, and that there's a lot of people that need to come together and get on the same page that hasn't really happened in the past.
Yeah, well, you know, what I would like to see happen this year, we've mentioned those amendments we'd like to bring in, or the to lower levels of rugby this year. Look, if we can be successful in getting that happening this year, and then at a higher level the following year, I think number one, we can get a hell of a lot more people wanting to watch the game. It's going to keep the Nine network a lot happier if people can see something is happening, something is different, something is more entertaining. And of course, their viewer numbers, if they're going to go up because we're trying something different, but it has to be seen to be different. We can't just fiddle with one or two areas of the game and think that's going to make a change. I think if we're going to get these dispensations approved to try here in Australia, we have to have some major changes. And I mean changes to scrums, changes to rolling mauls, changing to time, changes to yellow and bloody. We haven't talked about, you know, cards, red and yellow cards, but that's become crazy too. I think the whole thing with referees, I don't want to see referees on the sidelines mic'd up as, you know, as touch judges anymore. I'd like to see a central referee assisted by the people on the side if he asks for assistance. The TMO, he can't overrule anything the on-field referee says, but once again can be asked for assistance in the case of tries being scored. The big thing I'd like to see is that every time there's a rolling maul scored, to stop and have the TMO analyse it, because I've seen from experience in analysing rolling maul tries, there are more infringements by the attacking team that there are the defending team. So that's something there. But there's at least five or six areas of the games where major things have to be changed. And I think if they have the guts and the courage to do this, people will be encouraged then to watch a game that they can see is different, you know, and is more entertaining. And that's where my optimism at this stage stems from.
Well, it'll be very interesting. I think, you know, they've only a few weeks to act until,
exactly.
You know, the season starts very soon. And then, you know, it's bizarre this last year that we've had, you know, rugby. It only feels like rugby just ended, and it did.
That's right.
Sort of a month or so ago, but here we are. But look, Barry, I really appreciate it. Well, I think, there might be other areas that we haven't covered, and I'd be more than happy to talk again, perhaps later in the year. Maybe if the committee has been successful in some of those recommendations, and we've seen them play out in the season thus far, then that would be perhaps something we could come and have a chat and reflect, and then look at what the statistics are sort of saying. I'd be very interested.
I'd be delighted to do so. And of course, after we have a couple of meetings with this committee too, I can have a lot more to report back on as well. So, no, I'd be delighted to, Matt. And thank you very much for the opportunity too.
No pleasure, Barry. Well, look, you have a great day. Cheers, mate. And we'll talk again soon.
Thanks very much. Cheers, mate.
Thanks, mate. Cheers. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
This is the Gold Digger podcast series, a spin-off from the new feature documentary film Gold Digger, The Search for Australian Rugby, which will be coming out very soon. Brought to you by me, director and host, Matt Durrant, and sponsored by whoever wants to reach out and pay me to have their name up in lights. Music is by Makeup and Vanity Set, sourced from musicbed.com. Check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/golddiggerrugby. Follow us on Instagram for pretty pictures and Twitter for banal chatter. Till next time, keep on digging.